So, as an introduction to Sam's exhort this morning, he's asked that we read from John chapter 10, verses 1 to 21. I know my own, and my own know me. The Good Shepherd, Brother Sam.
Thanks, James, and good morning, everyone. Shout out to Brother Barry Stretton as well. So, in this section of John's Gospel, Jesus is trying to prepare his disciples for their preconceptions to be shattered. So the disciples' understanding of their Messiah was that he would be a mighty warrior who would come and defeat the Romans and re-establish the throne of David and rule the world from Jerusalem with Israel as the head of the nations. And you might vaguely recall last year at the Bible class we looked at John 11 and 12 and we saw that through that parable of Lazarus that Jesus was telling his disciples that their nation was going to die, represented by Lazarus, remain dead for a couple of thousand years and only then be resurrected. So their preconceptions about the immediate future of Israel and the timing of God's, the kingdom of God being established was about to be shattered. Their nation would become the head, the nation would be saved, but not until they'd gone through that all-important process of salvation, death and resurrection. The same process that all the people of God have to go through, the same process that we are going through at the moment, death and resurrection. Even their own Messiah, which they didn't understand at this stage, has to go through this process of death and resurrection. So the Jews' traditional understanding about both their Messiah and the future of their nation did not include this. They expected a Messiah who's going to come along on a white horse with a big sword, this mighty warrior to defeat the Romans and establish Israel as the head of all the nations. They're not expecting a Messiah who's going to be crucified by the Romans. And they're not expecting their own nation to be crushed by the same Romans in AD 70 and the land be dominated by Gentile powers for 1900 years. So the death and resurrection of Lazarus in chapter 11 and leading into chapter 12 is a prophecy about Israel, the death and the resurrection of the Jewish nation. It's not prefiguring Christ's death, it's prefiguring Israel's. But what about Christ himself? So unlike the nation of Israel, his own death and resurrection is a matter of days, not decades away when we come to John chapter 10. How does he prepare his disciples for this, shattering event that's going to take place in a few days? How does he try and make sure that his death is not, surprising, that it's not destroying the faith of his disciples, but in fact affirms the faith of his disciples? Well, John 10, I think, is partly how Christ does this. In this chapter, Christ is trying to prepare his disciples for what's about to happen to him personally and to them in the next days and months. And the other preconception that Jesus has to shatter for his disciples is that salvation is going to be found in the Jewish system of the first century. So the Jewish system, based on the law of Moses, system of legalism, of rituals, of synagogues and temple worship, it couldn't save anyone. And it was time for Jesus' disciples to separate from this. True discipleship is going to mean leaving Judaism behind. The two systems were not compatible, but contrasting, really. One could save, the other could not. And they couldn't remain in fellowship with both. So John chapter 10, the trouble, of course, with working with the Gospel of John and many of the other Gospels is that each chapter flows on from the one before. And, theoretically we could find ourselves sort of tracking John's ideas right back through to chapter 1, but you'll be pleased to know that in the interest of time we're not going to be doing that this morning. But the discussions of John chapter 10 flows directly on from the events of John chapter 9. So what happens in John chapter 9? Well, in short, much to the annoyance of the Jews, and particularly the scribes and Pharisees, a blind man got healed. And the Jews were so annoyed by this obvious display of God's power in Jesus that they threw the healed man out of the synagogue. So have a look at John chapter 9 and verse 22. So John chapter 9 and verse 22, these words spake his parents because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had agreed already that if any man did confess that he was Christ, that he should be put out of the synagogue. And then down in verse 33, the blind man makes his confession of faith, and he says, you know, to the Jews, you know, if this man, speaking about Jesus, were not of God, he could do nothing. And the Jews, true to their word, throw him out of the synagogue in verse 34. They answered and said unto him, thou wast altogether born in sins, and dost thou teach us? And they cast him out. And then in verse 35, Jesus heard that they had cast him out, this blind man that he'd healed. And when he had found him, he said unto him, dost thou believe on the Son of God? Now just note that phrase, cast him out. It's repeated in verse 34 and 35. Now the Greek word for that phrase is the word ekbalo. Now the Greek word ek means out of. We know it from ecclesia, called out ones. And balo, we know from ball, ballistics, it means to throw. So to throw out. So keep that word ekbalo in mind for John chapter 10. But it occurs there twice. That's what happens to this man who Jesus had healed. He's thrown out of the synagogue. So then John chapter 10 and Jesus' dissertation on the Good Shepherd. We're not going to sadly go into many of the qualities of shepherding this morning, but we are going to look at a few of them. John chapter 9 has given us a good picture of the men that should have been the shepherds of Israel, the scribes and the Pharisees, the Jews. So John chapter 9 showed us how the Jews treated their sheep, and especially a sheep like the blind man who, you know, clearly showed them that they were in error. And their solution is to throw that sheep out, cut him off. That saved them any embarrassment. You know, they weren't interested in the morals, they weren't interested in the rights or the wrongs. That didn't matter to them. So the Jewish synagogue, as it were, nominally the ecclesia of God, was not operated to save sheep. It was operated for the benefit of the shepherds. So what sort of shepherds were these men, these scribes and Pharisees? Well, they're the same type of shepherds that Ezekiel had described in Ezekiel chapter 34. Come back to Ezekiel 34 and we'll see the descriptions of the shepherds in Ezekiel's time. Now, just note in passing the position of this chapter in the book of Ezekiel. It's chapter 34. And after Ezekiel 34 comes, in mathematical progression, Ezekiel 35 and then Ezekiel 36 and then 37 and 38. And after John chapter 10, in mathematical progression, comes John chapter 11 and John chapter 12. So we're not going to go into the details now, but each of these chapters in John are based on the same prophecies that happen in Ezekiel 35, 36, 37, 38. So 37, we know the resurrection of Israel. 38, Gog comes down. Then 39 talks about the aftermath of that. And then 40, the building of the temple. All of that is in John chapter 10 and 11. And we saw some of that in our study classes last time. But now we go back a chapter in John and we find that it's based in an earlier chapter in Ezekiel. That's just in passing. Ezekiel 34, verse 1 to 5. And the word of Yahweh came unto me, saying, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. So here are the shepherds in Ezekiel's time. Prophesy and say unto them, Thus saith the Lord Yahweh unto the shepherds, Woe be to the shepherds of Israel, that do feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? So the focus of these shepherds was on themselves, not on the sheep. The ecclesia was for their benefit. Verse 3, you eat the fat, so obviously you can't carve off fat without killing the sheep. You know, you can't spill blood, you can't cut off fat. We all learnt from Merchant of Venice, you can't cut off the fat without, you know, spilling blood. So killing the sheep was required to eat the fat, and you clothe you with the wool, you kill them that are fed, but you feed not the flock. The diseased have you not strengthened, neither have you healed that which was sick. So the Pharisees couldn't physically heal the blind man in John chapter 9, but their role was to heal him spiritually, wasn't it? That's the role of the shepherds. But they didn't do that either, did they? Neither physical healing nor spiritual healing. They didn't do that job. Neither have you bound up that which was broken. Neither have you brought again that which was driven away. So, you know, far from bringing again that which was driven away, as John chapter 9 tells us, they did the driving away. They drove the sheep away. They ekbaloed them. Neither have you sought that which was lost, but with force and with cruelty have you ruled them. So as soon as they become uncomfortable with, you know, someone, they throw them out of the synagogue. And they, in verse 5, that is God's sheep, were scattered because there is no shepherd. They became meat to all the beasts of the field when they were scattered. So that's the shepherds of Ezekiel's day. But what's God's approach? Well, it's exactly the approach of his son who went to find the man cast out of the synagogue. He goes and finds the one that's been thrown out. So come down to verse 11 of Ezekiel 34. For thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, I, even I, will both search my sheep and seek them out. So words echoed in John chapter 9, verse 35. Jesus found the man who'd been cast out. Verse 12, as a shepherd seeketh out his flock in the day. And those words are echoed in John chapter 11 and verse 9. That he is among his sheep that are scattered. So will I seek out my sheep and will deliver them out of all places where they've been scattered in the cloudy and dark day. So such were the shepherds of Ezekiel's day. Such were the shepherds of Israel in Jesus' day. The men who were supposed to lead God's people. So come back to John chapter 10. How does Jesus describe these shepherds in similar sort of language? John chapter 10. Verse 1, Jesus says, they were thieves and robbers. In verse 5, they were strangers. In verse 10, they were thieves come to steal and kill. And in verse 12, they were hirelings who flee from the sheep at the first sign of threat to their person. But the good shepherd is different, isn't he? And there is only one good shepherd. The good shepherd is a counterintuitive shepherd. He's an illogical shepherd. So just think for a moment why you might, you know, become a shepherd. What would motivate you, speaking naturally? Surely it's so that you could get wool and meat from the sheep. That's why you become a shepherd, wouldn't it be? You should care for the sheep, but your natural motivation is that so that one day the sheep will feed you. They'll give their life for you. Preferably in the form of a nice roast dinner at some stage. But what does the good shepherd do? Verse 10, he gives his life to the sheep. He doesn't take their life for himself, he gives them life. Verse 15, I lay down my life for the sheep. So it's not just some sort of abstract life that Jesus gives to his sheep, it's his own life. So this good shepherd, surely he's got it round the wrong way. Surely. He's not a logical shepherd. He's a counterintuitive shepherd. The shepherds of Israel were natural shepherds. They're motivated by what they could get out of the sheep. This shepherd is motivated by what he can give the sheep. And that difference in motivation is really the key here. Christ laid down his life for his sheep, for us. He gave up his life. He dedicated his entire life to the benefit, to the salvation of others. And at no point in, you know, his 3.5 year ministry did Jesus come first for Jesus. He didn't live for Jesus. He lived for others. He lived for us. And the principle, not my will, but thine, ruled his mortal life. He laid down his life for the sheep. The Jewish shepherds were purely motivated by self. They lived their own life. They lived for themselves. And this really gets to our key principle. As we've sort of mentioned in passing already, God saves through death and resurrection. And the first death that has to happen is the death of our own pride, our own selfishness, and our own natural character. The Jews and the Pharisees were never going to submit to self-denial when they had the option of self-elevation. So they would never receive life and salvation. And salvation is the aim of the sheep, isn't it? So see verse 9. I am the door. If by me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved. So entering in is entering into salvation. And he shall go in and out and find pasture. So life, salvation from sin and death for the sheep is the aim of the Good Shepherd. So when it comes to the Good Shepherd in John chapter 10, what do we sort of see him doing? In verse 3, it says, to him the porter openeth, and the porter is God, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name and leadeth them out. So we probably have this image in our mind, probably from our, you know, Sunday school lessons or whatever, that we see him calling his sheep by name and leading them out of that great flock that is the world in general around us. So separating his sheep from humanity, generally speaking. Separation from the world. That's, you know, theoretically what it's all about. Well, I don't think that's what Jesus is saying here. So note carefully what happens in the first three verses of John chapter 10. Verily, verily, I say unto you, he that entereth not by the door into the sheepfold, but climbeth up by some other way, the same is a thief and robber. But he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the porter openeth, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calleth his own sheep by name, and leadeth them out. So there's a sheepfold, and some thieves and robbers have been entering in the sheepfold. You know, clear reference to the scribes and Pharisees that they should have been the shepherds of their day. But the true shepherd enters in by the door. And the porter opens the door to him, and that true shepherd calls his sheep and he leads them out. He leads them out of the sheepfold. Not into the sheepfold, but out of the sheepfold. So what's this sheepfold from which the good shepherd is leading his sheep? So the word for fold in sheepfold means, or literally just means, a yard, or, weirdly, a palace. And it's used 12 times in the New Testament, and of those 12 times, two are in this chapter. And of the remaining 10 times that this word is used, eight refer to the palace of the high priest, where Jesus was tried before his crucifixion. So the fold, or the yard, really, that the palace from which Jesus is calling his sheep is, in the first instance, not the world in general, but the Jewish synagogues, the temple, the palace of the high priest, the existing Orthodox religion of his day. And verse 4 really reinforces this idea. In verse 4, John says, "And he putteth forth, when he putteth forth his own sheep, he goeth before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice." So Jesus' sheep aren't going in, he's putting them forth. They're headed out. And the Greek word for putteth forth, it's our word ekbalo, that was in John chapter 9, to throw out. So exactly the same Greek word as cast in John chapter 9, verse 34, and John chapter 9, verse 35. And where had the previously blind man been ekbaloed from? He'd been thrown out of the Jewish synagogue. So I think what Jesus is saying here is that the same thing that happened to that once blind man is going to happen to all my sheep, says the Good Shepherd. They're all going to be cast out, ejected from the synagogue. And it's not the Jews casting them out, it's Jesus himself removing them from the synagogues and the temples of the Jews. He puts them forth, it says in verse 4. He puts them forth. He ekbalos his own sheep. He throws them out. He puts them forth out of the synagogue of the Jews. So for Jesus' immediate disciples, they had to leave behind the synagogue to follow him. And for Jesus' disciples today, we have to leave behind the orthodox religion of our day to follow him. Now, we're not going to go into details about this morning, but the parallels between Jesus' disciples leaving Jewish orthodoxy and us leaving Christian orthodoxy are pretty clear, and that's a whole other subject. But that's the point here, that we have to come out of that system to form part of Christ's ecclesia. So I think Jesus is saying, I've come to do exactly what you did to the once blind man back in chapter 9. I've come to cast out my sheep, to cast them out of the synagogue. I've come to lead my sheep out of the fold, out of the palace of the high priest, as that word's used. I've come to call my sheep out of Judaism. And all my disciples are going to have to go through what this healed blind man went through in chapter 9 in order to be my disciples. You can't remain in the Jewish sheepfold and be my disciples. Now, verse 16 makes this point even more clearly, although the King James Version doesn't really help. So John chapter 10 and verse 16, other sheep I have that are not of this fold. So he's talking about the Gentiles now. He's saying I'm also calling the Gentiles, not just the Jews, which are not of this fold. So notice that word. Them also I must bring, and they shall hear my voice, and there shall be one fold and one shepherd. So now this gets a little bit Greek word technical, but you'll notice that the word fold in verse 16 appears twice, but it's not actually the same Greek word. It's two different Greek words. And the first word translated fold, when he says, I have other sheep which are not of this fold, is the same word as in verse 1, sheepfold, their yard or the palace. So some of Jesus' sheep are, in the words of verse 16, not of that fold. They're not of the Jewish palace. They're not of the synagogue. They're the Gentiles. But in the second half of verse 16, they're still going to be what part of his one fold, which is going to be Jew and Gentile combined, obviously. And the second word for fold in verse 16 is a different Greek word, and it means simply a flock. So it's not talking about a place, it's not talking about a yard, but just a group of sheep. So Jesus' flock is not part of the Jewish yard, it's not part of the Jewish sheepfold, it's not part of the synagogue, not part of the palace of the high priest. There is only one flock, which is Jesus' ecclesia. And part of that flock is sourced from the Jews, the sheepfold of verse 1, and part of it's sourced from the Gentiles. So some have been called from the Jewish yard, as it were, and others will be called that are not part of the Jewish yard. They're the Gentiles. But they'll all become part of the one flock of Jesus, which is a different word to sheepfold. So here's some shocking news for Jesus' disciples. You know, they're brought up, they believe that salvation was by law, that salvation was by association with, you know, places like temples and synagogues. They believe that the epitome of a religion was the Pharisee, with all their, you know, fanaticism about rituals and cleanliness on the outside and apparent righteousness. They couldn't conceive of a relationship with God, let alone salvation, that didn't involve adherence to a building of some sort, ideally a temple or, you know, failing that, a synagogue. And now here in John chapter 10, Jesus is telling them firstly that the Pharisees are terrible, self-centred, selfishly motivated shepherds, as bad as the shepherds of Ezekiel's day. Jesus is telling them that not only did the temple, the palace of the high priest, the synagogue not save them, but unless they come out of that system, unless they're ekbaloed out of that system, they're not going to receive life. They're not going to receive salvation. So salvation was not going to be via association with the synagogue. Salvation is now going to be association by association with the Good Shepherd. Salvation was going to be in following the Good Shepherd wherever he led them, particularly outside the sort of safe and comfortable confines of the sheep fold, the Jewish sheep fold. Jesus' flock is identified not by the building they meet in, but by hearing his voice. So in verse 3, they hear his voice. Jesus' flock is going to be identified by following him. In verse 4, his sheep follow him. And John chapter 10, verse 27 and 28 really sums up our relationship with our shepherd. My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me, and I give unto them eternal life. The end point of this whole exercise. Now, the good shepherd is not just a shepherd, or the shepherd, is he? He's also a door. He's the door. So in verse 7, Jesus says, I am the door. And again in verse 9, I am the door. What's he the door to? Well, again, verse 9 makes this pretty clear. I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved, and shall go in and out and find pasture. So note that men are not entering into the Jewish sheepfold through this door. They're entering into salvation. The thieves and robbers of verse 1 entered into the sheepfold, but they were the Pharisees entering the Jewish system of things. But that's not the same as entering into salvation. The Jewish synagogues, the law itself, as we know, could not save. But we enter through a door into salvation. And we enter salvation through the door, and the door is Jesus himself. But what did verse 2 say? Back in John chapter 10, verse 2, he that entereth in by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. So the shepherd enters through the door, but Jesus is the shepherd, and Jesus is the door, but Jesus goes through the door as well. How can he be the door and yet enter in through the door? It sounds, pretty confusing, almost contradictory, doesn't it? They're fairly simple words, fairly simple images, aren't they? But they're key to a really profound idea here. So verse 9, as we've seen, makes it clear that the door is the route to salvation. So when Jesus says, I am the door, and I enter through the door, that really means that Jesus is both the method of salvation and he goes through that same method or process of salvation as his sheep. He's saved by the same method that we are saved. And once saved, he becomes the method of our salvation. So again, at the risk of becoming monotonous, death and resurrection is God's method of salvation. Jesus was saved through death and resurrection. Firstly, moral, death to his own nature, and walking in newness of life during his 33 and a half years on earth. And then he demonstrated that physically on the cross, in the grave, and then resurrected to literal life, immortal life. And we follow that same pattern, don't we? We enter through the door that he has revealed for us. So if you were to link a door with salvation, as Christ does in verse 9, speaking to a Jewish audience, where do you think their mind would go? I'm pretty sure it would go straight to the Passover in Exodus chapter 12. So what happened in the Passover? Exodus 12, there's an angel of death coming, isn't there? How do we escape the sword of that angel? By painting the doorway of our house with the blood of a lamb. And by entering in through that bloody doorway, we can reach salvation. What's the principle? The principle is death and resurrection, sacrifice and life. The lamb, as we know, Christ is the lamb, the Passover lamb. He gives his blood, his life, so that we can live. In another paradox, of course, he's the lamb, but he's also the good shepherd. He's numbered among the people that he came to save. He saved through the means of salvation, which is himself. Outside the house at the Passover is death. Inside the house, through the door painted with the blood of the sacrifice, a life poured out for others is salvation. If we enter in through a doorway that doesn't have the blood of the Lamb on it, we're not entering in salvation, are we? Salvation is only through those principles of death and resurrection. So I'm going through that door, says Jesus. And then, having gone through that door, I will become the door through which we, his sheep, can enter and be saved. How will I enter salvation? Asked Jesus. By laying down my natural, selfish life. By crucifying the flesh with its affections and lusts. By doing God's will instead of my own. First in my daily life, as a mortal, and then symbolically on the cross. And when I've done that perfectly, I expect my sheep to follow me through the same door, the door of laying down your life, your pride, your selfishness, so that you can instead do God's will, so that you can serve your fellow sheep like I did. And that's what this morning is about, isn't it? Jesus shared the bread and the wine with his disciples at the Last Supper, and so set us a pattern to follow. The wine is his blood, the bread is his flesh. The same principles that saved him save us. He set the path, and we follow. In verse 4 of John chapter 10, Jesus goeth before them, the good shepherd goeth before his sheep. And that implies that we, his sheep, follow him wherever he leads us. He treads the path of salvation and expects us to follow. In verse 4, his sheep do follow him. In verse 5, they don't follow strangers. In verse 27, they follow me. We follow him through that same door. He didn't do it so that we don't have to do it. There's no, you know, doctrine of substitution being preached here. He did it to give us a pattern to follow. And what is that pattern? The pattern is a life of sacrifice. Come in conclusion to 1 Peter chapter 2. 1 Peter 2 and verse 21. For even hereunto were ye called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps. So exactly the same principles that we've seen in John chapter 10 are here in 1 Peter chapter 2. Christ suffered for us as an example so that we can follow. Who did no sin, neither was guile found in his mouth. Who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. Who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, in the same, exactly the same way, being dead to sins, should live unto righteousness, death and resurrection, by whose stripes ye were healed. For ye were as sheep going astray, but are now returned unto the shepherd and bishop of your souls. It's easy to follow Christ when he's the Messiah that we expect, when he's the shepherd that we expect. Jesus' own disciples, Peter and Andrew and even Judas, were keen to follow him when they thought that Jesus was going to overthrow the Romans in a show of strength and establish the kingdom of God on earth. But what about when he's not the shepherd that we expect? What about when his life is not one of kingship, but of sacrifice? Can we still follow him then? What about when he is a man who dedicates his whole life to others instead of himself? Can we still follow him then? What about when his life is not one of pride and self-elevation and demonstrations of power, but a life of humility? Can we still follow him then? And can we follow, even more importantly, not just his actions, but his motivation? And that's the key difference, isn't it, between the Messiah the disciples were expecting, between the leaders that they already had, and the Christ that God sent. What did he do? He said in verse 10, I am come that they might have life. That's John chapter 10, verse 10. Why did he do it? Verse 11, for the sheep. Verse 13, for the sheep. Verse 15, for the sheep. His motivation is to do it for others. And if we can get the motivation right, putting ourselves last, elevating others, acting out of agape love, love without a cause, our actions will follow. We will follow him, and he will give us his life, eternal life.